Welcome to the Nerd Party.
I'm Darren Moser.
I'm Philip Gilfus.
I'm Daniel Prue.
And this is City Alpha 3.
Welcome to City Alpha 3, a Star Trek podcast here on the Nerd Party Network. I am Darren, joined as always by my fellow Strandees on New SETI. Are we changing the name, guys? Can we have a quorum on it? But no, I'm joined here with Philip and Daniel. Happy American Thanksgiving as well as the time of this recording. Holiday has just passed, and hopefully we're giving thanks in our own family.
We've already moved on.
Anybody?
It's Christmas music time, man.
Okay, like, yeah. It is Christmas. It was already Christmas music time.
Yeah, because it's Christmas, I decorate the house like everyone does. I put up the tree, put on the paintings of the ancestors that look a lot like me, put in the carousel, you know, just a regular Christmas decorations like Star Trek has taught us.
Yeah. Well, you hang the little Voyager, then Q finds it. You play game. It's a lot of fun.
And then I had to plug in the ornament with the exploding star in it. You know, those are a bit of a to plug in. But
If your ornaments are giving you pause about the existential case of life in general, is it really even Star Trek Christmas? But
you just got to throw the red matter accessory at that exploding star, and you'll be totally fine. Don't you worry about it.
Now, Darren, I thought you were correct. We are renaming. This is actually City Alpha 4, isn't it?
This is City Alpha 4. You're right. We are joined by our guest, Lindsay, friend of the network. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your Trek? What's your favorite series? We'll go with that.
Hi. So I'm Lindsay. I am currently in Edinburgh in Scotland. And my favorite Trek is Voyager. I grew up with Voyager. Janeway was very much kind of like my role model as a kind of girl. And it just arrived at exactly the right point for me. So nobody in my household was particularly Trekkie growing up, but sort of, or geeky in any way, really. But TNG was an acceptable thing to be on of an evening. So I kind of got indoctrinated, and then I discovered there was a new season coming and there was a captain and she was a woman. Anyway, long story short, I'm still watching Trek now. I do some podcasting with some guys in the UK, and I am generally to be found on Twitter.
Wonderful. Yeah, we have a side chat often going on with other members of the Nerd Party Network, and we were talking about Star Trek, as we often do, and I found this article somebody posted as if it was a real scientific article, but it was written about Threshold, about like going faster than warp 10 and lizard babies. But it was all written like dead serious scientifically. And it was a fun read.
The only problem with Threshold was the fact that they kept referring to evolution. If they had stopped talking about evolution, that episode was absolutely solid.
That's a Brandon Braga-ism, right? I'm pretty sure he wrote that episode, and he also wrote Genesis, right from TNG, where they're also de-evolving. It's the same sort of thing where it's frustrating as hell. It's like,
well, he went to the Super Mario Brothers, the movie school of evolution.
Oh, man. You should clarify, not actually Super Mario Brothers, but Super Mario Brothers,
but the movie. Yes. That's what you're talking about. I mean, that's how I learned. That's what my science textbook talks about. When the asteroid hit and split our two worlds apart, the dinosaurs went to one and evolved with mushrooms. And I can't even finish the sentence. But
now, Lindsay, on your list for Father Christmas, are you going to get the Voyager book that is out now? Sort of the all things Voyager.
I'm honestly not sure if it's actually been released here yet. Yes, between that and the Janeway autobiography, both of those are on lists. I suspect nobody will buy them for me, so I'm probably going to end up buying them for myself.
Merry Christmas to me.
Oh, Joe, the number of things that I have treated myself to this year because I'm not spending money on other things is slightly insane.
Well, you'll recognize the Voyager book as it has the Doctor, Catherine Janeway, and Seven on the cover.
The only character.
Just like the last three seasons,
Yeah.
And I also heard news, and this I hadn't heard about this, that apparently there's a Voyager-style documentary in the works, like, you know, Deep Space Nine. Apparently there's going to be a Voyager
one. Different style, I think, than Far Beyond the Stars, but anything would be interesting to see. Can we get those Voyager bloopers, finally?
You know what? I would take them. Other than seeing the stuff with Jean-Vive Bujold, there's not a huge amount of stuff out there, and that was fairly traumatizing to the first time I saw that and realized that my Janeway was not the original Janeway.
Oh, yes, Genevieve,
I believe that they are recording it, and they did some stuff on the last Trek cruise, but obviously, as with many things in 2020, it has been delayed due to a virus.
Well, you know, I think they're a little behind on the Millennium Gate. I don't think it's been finished yet, so...
I think we should stop referring to really bad episodes of Voyager. Maybe your ancestors so look just like you.
Well, I also think it's
Daniel's favorite thing.
Let's not even get into it. With all that, and the announcement of Janeway as the captain or a featured character, at least, in the Nickelodeon show.
Prodigy.
Everything's coming up Janeway, right?
It is. So I am very excited about that, and I am slightly concerned because we still haven't got Lower Decks over here, so I'm not sure where I'm going to be getting this Nickelodeon show from, but you know, I might have to travel to America once a week for a while to view it.
We'll save it on VHS and mail it over.
Think of another device you might want to put on your Christmas list.
Transporter maybe, or you know, a TARDIS. But the other thing that's quite interesting is, like I say, I'm very excited about it, and I'm really excited that Kate Mulgrew is excited about it. But there is also a small part of me that goes, kind of taking the easy way out there, though, haven't you? Because rather than address the fact that she is a woman who is no longer the same age as she was when she finished filming, and unlike Patrick Stewart, has not been stuck in a time warp and apparently not aged for the last 20 years.
Patrick Stewart is not on the bell curve.
No,
so we
Patrick
don't even
well, he,
talk
he's
about
an unreasonable
that.
Expectation, I feel. So he should just stop, but it's just not helpful. But in any case, they've taken a slightly easy out in that they, by going animated, they have kind of avoided that question. However, I'm excited to have her back, and I will take what I can get.
There's always a chance she shows up in Picard season 2, though. There's no reason why she couldn't.
There's a lot of hope there. I think there was a lot of chat and back and forth about that. It'll be interesting, because obviously, Seven's experience in the story and the arc that she had in Picard season 1 kind of implies that she has lost all contact with the majority of the Voyager crew. And that kind of didn't sit right with me. So I was like, come on, guys. And he's like, where's the EMH? Like, he would be an obvious person to reintroduce. So I would love to see it. But we shall just have to wait and see. I'm not going to hold my breath. Much like Prime Lorca reappearing in Discovery.
I'm still a little... you know, disappointed that, or feel bad that, you know, look at the documentaries, you get like DS9, what you felt, you know, what left behind is this lovely thing.
What you fell behind, is that what you said?
And then you get Voyager, which is going to be this, you know, lovely letter about this great, and then TNG gets like, man, the first two seasons sucked. That's our documentary.
Yeah, it's true. What was that, Chaos on the Bridge?
Where's our documentary? Come on.
Yeah, that's
we
true.
Get, well, I mean, we get Blu-rays.
When you're the favorite stepchild, it pretty much, like, you don't get the special treatment.
You get Blu-rays. You don't get to complain about it.
No, that's true. That's true.
When I get Voyager,
look, we had that one episode where you see DS9 and Quark. I mean, that's a love letter from us to DS9 fans.
You can watch Nick Locarno in HD.
That's
about as close to Voyager as I think you're going to get. So,
you know what? I have been known to dabble in some of the darker corners of the Star Trek fandom and in the world of fan fiction, and Nick Locarno is a plot device that never fails to entertain.
It's like Nick Locarno and Thomas Riker.
Hey,
have they ever
met in the novelverse? Has Nick Locarno and Tom Paris ever met? If they have not done that, that would be an amazing book. Why wouldn't somebody write that?
surely Nick Locarno would turn out to be the illegitimate offspring of Admiral Paris, yes?
Yeah, you would think so, right? Yeah.
So, okay, so you have Nick Locarno and Tom Paris, then you have Data and Lore, and then you have Thomas Riker and Will, and you get all the doubles and put them together. And then the whole Oblivion crew just kind of like floating in proto matter in the background because we had to name another Bad Voyager episode.
Oblivion is not a Bad Voyager episode.
No, it's not.
It was ironically the only time we saw the Vlana Tom wedding, whereas in the real characters was offspring.
Well, why show it twice? The viewers have seen it.
You know what? Like, yes, arguably that is a good argument. If we're going to talk about kind of weird offstage things, one of my favorite inclusions in a very good book called Mosaic by Jerry Taylor, which is mostly about Janeway's back history, is a date between Will Riker and Catherine Janeway while they're at the Academy that doesn't happen because she blows him off, but it's great.
Now, and it's also great that we have Lindsay on, you know, with such love for Voyager, talking about, you know, what it's like for a character, an ensign, really, who seems like they're going to be an ensign forever. You know, what it would be like to suddenly be vaulted.
Oh, we'll get there, Philip. We'll get there.
Yeah, Harry Kim is rolling in his grave several centuries away. Let's put it that way.
Not flashback. The Ice Planet one.
Yeah.
Where he was a captain, I think, at that point. Or no, I'm misremembering. But he had been promoted one timeline. He actually got promoted.
And the season finale, the series finale, he's captain.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking of, where he doesn't want to, he's really upset that she's going to change time and he'll be back at square one.
This is the only timeline where I get promoted.
Little selfish, Harry, but you know, I guess we'll go through that. But no, today we are going to be talking about Unification Part 3, I think the first third part of a Star Trek episode
ever.
At least by name. Yeah, Part 3 with the Vulcan salute. And this is, of course, episode 7 of season 3 of Star Trek Discovery. And there's a lot to unpack here. Now, Philip and Daniel and myself did a primer for this, and we all rewatched Unification 1 and 2 because it had been a little while. And I, as we were kind of chatting, it held up, like, regarding even the fact that it's a fairly old episode. Let's see, this was.
Don't do the math.
Was released.
This is the episode that actually features the in memory of Gene Roddenberry. So I believe this is right as he died.
It is.
This would be 92, right? So we're
91. November 91. So yeah, I noticed that too. It has said in loving memory, and it's like, oh well, of course, all the ones I pick has like the
now, Darren,
the sad card.
Is this on your? I know you're writing all these things down on your list of records that Star Trek Discovery is making, that the Star Trek franchise is making. Like you already said that Lower Decks is the longest pilot
from from Lower Decks the episode to Lower Decks the series of like 20 years, 3 months, 8 days.
Now, is this
like
the longest sequel?
It's got to be. Well, it's the only, because they always did 1 and 2 like right next to each other.
Well,
and then part 3.
It depends on what we're considering sequels, because the cage in memory.
The number next to it.
The cage. Yeah. But I could see your advocate for the cage and the menagerie as being kind of tied together. But I still think this outstrips it. I mean, it's...
Or even Tribbles 90. And Tribbles. That was the 25-year anniversary, so that was 25 years in between.
That's true.
It doesn't have a number in it, but I don't know if that matters.
Well, this is 29 years difference between 91 and 2020. So that's...
I'll tell myself that I felt, you know, I was like, I think I'm going to tell you, like, oh, I'm so smart, blah, blah, blah. Like, when it was called Unification 3... Like, I was like, well, that's dumb. It should be called Unification Part 3. And then I'm watching the TNG episode, and it's literally called Unification 1.
2.
Unification 2. I was like, when did we do that? I thought it was always Part 1 and Part 2. Oh, well.
Yeah, this is a special time. It was.
Well, can I also ask a silly question? Why is it Unification as opposed to Reunification?
Good question.
Because they talk a lot about reunification in Unification 1 and 2.
And they like
Star Trek likes its one word titles, I guess, or maybe they were unsure if it was a re-dash unification.
So back in here's the thing. Here's the actual reason. In 1991, all of those blue letters that they use for the title cards are really expensive. It's like $5,000.
They can't even use them anymore. So that would be crazy.
That's why we didn't have these like paragraph long titles in TNG. We didn't do that back then. It wasn't until the 21st century when you can, you know, digitally create.
Also,
these
the microfilm
titles.
Tape we used to record personal logs at the beginning to talk about what was going on. That oh my gosh, like the economy was not kind to that stuff. It is really expensive.
Yeah, that's
just what the BBC did with the Doctor Who tapes and recorded over it.
Oh, just right.
There you go.
That's why the TNG logs are always like just straight to the point. We don't have time, you know. Captain's log, we're going to, you know, Rakkis 5.
No.
And then like now in the 21st century, your log, you can just talk with
whatever. We're there. We're already there.
Yeah. You know, like I'm gonna write a poem. This is my log. You know.
Although I'm pretty sure in. Maybe I'm mixing this up with other shows I'm watching right now, but did this episode open up with like a flashback of like previously on? I forget
Are we talking about Unification 3?
Yes.
Yeah. So there was a previously on. It was about 1 minute 45. And of that 1 minute 45, one scene was not about Michael Burnham.
It's kind of like Discovery as a whole, really, if you think about it. Yeah,
which is a real shame, and I will happily talk ad nauseum about the balance issues, because I think I come at this from a generally more positive view about Discovery than I think that you guys do. But it does have one or two particularly bad habits. That's one of them.
We'll talk about that for sure when we get into it, I'm sure.
Well, it's okay, guys, because they call it out. So when they say Burnham knows she has an endearing messianic complex, it's okay now because she said it.
Well, I thought it was interesting that, was it her mom? I forget, because everyone says it. But someone said, like, your old boyfriend.
I think Book said it. Yeah.
Oh, because like someone mentioned like Tyler, didn't they? Or like your old boyfriend?
Her mom called her out big style. Her mom absolutely called her out.
Her mom like roasted her in this episode.
It's quite satisfying.
Yeah.
Because I think Michael was like, oh yeah, you know, he used to say this. I'm like, everyone.
And she's
said
like,
that.
Mom, you're supposed to be on my side. She's like, I've sworn to absolute candor and we're going to. Which, I mean, let's just start. We'll start there. Like, that was a great callback to Picard.
Love it.
It was this new. You know,
it's
interweaving.
Such a weird place to start. it's so bizarre. But you're throwing us into the middle of like the trial of the episode.
Okay, fine.
Make the black alert sound when you do that.
Yeah. I got whiplash, man. I just wasn't ready to be directly into the fire here. Okay.
I just meant more that it was this really interesting connection to Picard, and it's the first time we've kind of seen Discovery reference something that's not TOS. You know, or something else, meaning it's, you know, it's nice. We like it when Star Trek references Star Trek because there's a lot of Star Trek out there. So that was often fun.
Did you all have any guesses around if you were spoiled or not about like what would be under the hood?
I mean, I didn't. I felt like.
I mean, her mom was
so short.
Yeah.
Well, it was so short between the time of, oh, here's your advocate and here's the reveal. It was like 10 seconds. So I didn't have time to even think about it. But I think it should have been someone else? Like, it, I don't know. I've heard people reference, I mean, it is what it was. And I think the choice was obviously to have someone who could actually knew Michael enough to point out her flaws, but a real trained advocate could research and figure that out themselves, so it kind of could have been anybody. But someone suggested online, like, if it had been someone who's maybe like a follower of the teachings of Spock or something like that, who isn't going to give Burnham a pass but also can look into their archives and such and figure out, like, you know, this is what she's done on public record and not necessarily be her mother. But yeah, I didn't have time to register on who this was going to be before they revealed it.
I think we had spoken, certainly on Trek Without, a lot about the fact that we were expecting Burnham's mom to rock up eventually. I thought she might be the evil empress of the Orion/Andorian syndicate.
Ooh.
Just because, well, I felt like we were being told about her as though we were going to recognize her when we did see her. But obviously that's not the case. I totally agree, though, that I think the callback to the Quilat Malat was fabulous. And I actually love the fact that they have gone from, like, warrior nuns, the Romulan warrior nun sect, into a kind of advocacy place, because that sits really nicely with history and how cultures have developed. I like that. I think it's good.
Taking on lost causes still.
Still taking on lost causes. And absolute candor has a place in those things. Now, you can argue whether or not she was being absolutely candid. When she was referring to, there's somebody else in the room, you have another audience. Doesn't feel very candid. But yeah.
No, I think, yeah, as I've tossed us into the middle of this fire, but yeah, I
was a little disappointed
that but
it didn't turn out to be like a rap battle, because I was assuming, you know, as a Hamilton fan, once they, like, you know, said we're gonna have like a logic off,
so she drops it and then she hits the gong and drops the mallet, like, you know, like a mic style.
Yeah. I don't know. Daniel, I know you're the Vulcan Romulan of it all around here. Like, isn't that the weirdest panel? Like, the logic off? Like, I can see, like, we want to build
a logic off.
We want to build a dramatic thing. We're not going to do a trial because we've done trials, but we're going to do something
I'm
like a
trial. I'm surprised they weren't sitting, like, 8 stories above them looking down. That seems to be the Vulcan way of judging people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, where do I start? I have a lot of
Were they logic things. Extremists for you, Daniel?
Was their logic extreme enough?
I mean, I get it, what they were going for, right? They're supposed to represent the political spectrum on this planet, and it makes sense. Honestly, my favorite part of the episode is the idea, just the idea that, from what we understand about what happens between Vulcan and Romulus, plus shoved in here with a bunch of extra time, and then what happens to the planet of Romulus, that essentially all the Romulans go to settle on Vulcan, and they start to reintegrate. And it takes time, and there's lots of growing pains, and that's cool. That's exactly what I live for. Like, that's what I want to see. The panel makes sense in a shortcutty kind of way of, like, because it does still feel like they're kind of like now times Romulans and now times Vulcans. Like, there doesn't feel like there's been any integration at all, or little, I should say. I mean, if it's been a
So there's little Romulus in the middle of the Vulcan city.
Well, yeah, they keep bringing it up like that.
They have the best. Yeah. Oh, have you ever had their soup there? You can't get that anywhere on Vulcan.
But it was
Romulans terraformed half the planet and left the other half an arid desert for the Vulcan people.
Yeah, it was fine. I liked Vulcan president lady. She was cool.
Yeah, she was really cool. I think hopefully we're going to see her again more.
I think her relationship with Saru was really interesting as well. It was kind of his inner diplomat came out, and I enjoyed that back and forth. And for me, you know, the bits where she was talking about, it wasn't just as simple as BD-19. Like, it wasn't just about that. It wasn't just about the burn that this had been coming for a long time. That's where you start getting a bit more dimension into those discussions. So that was really good.
Yeah, and I think it did a good job of, I mean, obviously there's going to be political ramifications and it's not as clear cut, but it wasn't like, let's take you through the political process of this planet because that's boring and we don't want to watch that. Star Trek. Or Star Wars 2. Okay, well, I just wanted to, uncover that. And sorry,
also,
I jumped us in the middle of this.
Are we never
going to
say the word Raymond's? Are we never going to say that word?
No, I guess they got wiped out.
Here's the thing.
They get a moon.
They have to acknowledge it, though. They have to acknowledge it. It's whatever. Poor Nemesis. I get it, but poor Nemesis.
Yeah.
Poor Ron Perlman. Poor Ron Perlman. What are you doing?
He is a great Reeman.
I feel like we don't have time to get into Nemesis as well.
No. Okay.
I have
right
feelings
along
on Nemesis.
So. Okay, so we get to Burn. I mean, the other main throughput of this episode is basically Burnham coming back around into feeling her place on the Starfleet crew, and I think they did a good job. I mean, they did it in one episode, which is a lot, but, you know, at the beginning of or the end of last episode, you know, if she had just gotten on the ship with Booker and left, I would not have been surprised. Like, that was the way she was headed. You know, she's lost her number one position. She's just a science officer and she's feeling lost. So, you know, she's confiding in Book, you know, he, you know, isn't quite sure what to do, where his place is. Nobody knows what anyone's doing at this point. We're trying to figure it out.
I have a question about the Booker Michael of it all. And maybe I know the answer, but I don't think they need to tell us per se, but my question is, how long have they been together? Like, I guess the way the show presents it is like you're seeing as it happens, like they just got together. But I'm like, it just feels like they just had a year of Will They Won't They. And like, because I almost feel like I want to.
Yeah, kind
of. I just almost want to do like a backstory of like they've been together for like 6 months or something, you know, like, you know, but, you know, I don't know. I guess it's not the biggest thing, but I'm just kind
maybe
of
maybe a week or so.
Just seems like it's a weird boiling point that like, or whatever word I'm trying to use here. Like Discovery comes back and like, oh, now we want to make out. It's like, okay, the whole year was just like. Attention.
Yeah, well, you know, she wanted to be able to move out of her quarters and crash in the cargo bay, in the apartment in the cargo bay, basically.
Well, we know that Tilly snores, so.
That's.
Kills the mood.
That's, well.
Okay, so I want to talk about this since you brought it up because I don't understand it and it frustrates me to no end. I want to talk about Michael Burnham's personal journey from this season because it makes no sense to me and they
it's been a roller coaster, guys.
They cleaned it up so sloppily in this episode.
Okay. A tear or two.
Michael Burnham goes into the future and then Discovery comes back a year afterwards. We're given to think that something tragic or crazy or messed up happened to her because as soon as they get back, she's like, I don't know if I fit in with these people. I don't know my place. And for three episodes or four episodes, however long it is, she doesn't know what her place is and she feels slightly off or whatever. Because we think something happened in that year.
Like she doesn't want to be a part of the chain of command anymore.
She's gone through some
her own decision.
Yeah, she's gone through some sort of crazy.
I've been in a lot of gray areas or
transformation.
Something.
Yeah. Maybe it's her love with Book. I don't know, but there's something.
I felt like it was less something crazy and more, again, that chain of command thing that she has been her own captain. She's made her own decisions and now she's back in the chain of command machine and now added with a very different Starfleet at the top. And that's a lot.
I think we can't discuss this in isolation though, because she has a history of not thinking that other people have the right idea.
Season one, episode one.
Yeah.
Which they keep bringing up.
The night.
Yeah, but that's the struggle for me, which is why I enjoyed the fact her mom called it out, because like this is not particularly new behavior, and I would understand like having a year away from everybody else where maybe she thought they weren't going to rock up and she was going to have to be on her own.
That's true.
Would result in a kind of a change of mindset, and that it would be difficult coming back after that. And she's
you have to let yourself let go enough to not be crushed if they never come back.
Yeah, precisely. And she's clearly, for me, it feels like she's displaced all of this concern into her kind of obsession with the burn. Because why she is obsessed with the burn makes no real sense. Unless it is a displacement.
They share a same last name. Yeah. So
and the likelihood is she'll find the solution to it because that's kind of how this rolls.
Well, she's going to be the cause and the solution.
Which will frustrate me too, because as much as I love Discovery, this does frustrate me.
Well, this season we'll find out what the burn was. Next season we'll find out what the ham was.
No. But yeah, in any case, like I think that we can't... And I suppose that's where my frustration about the lack of consequences comes from, because she's lost her position as first officer, but she's still a commander and she hasn't been cashiered or like removed from
the
ship.
She likes being put in the brig, just like Mariner.
So we've demoted you to the position that you've shown time and time again, science officer. Yeah.
She should be in prison, man. And here's the thing, too. And it happens in this episode. It happens again in this episode.
Oh, yeah. She totally just does whatever she fancies.
She pulls it on the bridge, and Saru has no idea what's going on. And I'm like, man, you need to shut her down and get her out of there, because she literally is...
Oh, where she invokes the thing and she's like,
this
is my plan all along. And we're like...
But every time she gets away with it because the writers give her... Because she's right in the end.
No. The problem is she gets away with it because she has to get away with it because they have chosen to make the protagonist of this series somebody who is not in command. And as soon as they did that, they have created a situation whereby they have to force her into the center of every situation. Ugh. And that for me is the struggle. Like, I like Burnham's character. I think if they were using her differently, there are lots of possibilities there. But because they set out from the start that Burnham was the main character, but she was not in command, they then have to shoehorn her into everything, which is why it feels like this is the Burnham show as opposed to the Discovery crew show. And it's why she consistently has to have a messianic complex, because she has to be the one who thinks she knows best and the one to find the solutions.
Well, we were chatting, you know, back in the Trill episode, we were like, why isn't Dr. Culber going down with Adira to the planet and all of that? It was like, why Michael? It's like, because it's She's the protagonist.
But that's the thing, though. Star Trek has always been an ensemble show. Even when they're like the captains were the main characters, you would have a Troy episode, or you would have even a Harry Kim episode.
But there would also be 24 episodes a season.
Well, that's fine. But I'm just saying, we can't make excuses for bad writing when she doesn't have to always be right. She could still be wrong and learn a lesson, or she could still fail and learn a lesson. She could have gone to that planet in the last episode with Scavenge Planet, whatever it's called, and
the Emerald Chain.
Yeah, and all those miners, those slave miners, could have died, and then that sting would have been so much worse but she was right. She got the good evidence. She knew what she was doing, and she was right. And every time, I'm just getting so. It's the same thing. It's just the same thing. And what I was frustrated about in this one was what I was talking about earlier. She didn't know her place. She doesn't know her place. I don't know where I want to be. And then this episode, she doesn't even learn anything, but she's all of a sudden, now I'm comfortable. Here I am on Discovery. I'm happy to be here now. I'm glad. Now let's all high five, and I'm back on Discovery now. And I'm fine. Okay. I mean, I guess that's what we're doing.
Until she disagrees with Tilly and Saru and goes off and does what she wants again.
With Book, who's exactly. Now her onboard getaway. I think, for me, there's lots of frustration in the place that, you know, she's like, oh, I'm here representing Starfleet, but it's still very much I. So, like, I will go out and do this research, and I will give it to you, and I will.
She doesn't even know who Starfleet is. Like, it's like I represent Scotland. I've never lived there, and I don't know what it's like, but I can say I represent them. Sure. It's like, no.
Oh, yeah? Starfleet?
Can you even name all the planets?
Well, Lindsay, I'm curious, or at least, you know...
Do you have a United Federation of Planets flag hanging over your bed, Michael? Is it?
But Lindsay, I'm curious, because, like, for this episode, and I always feel like when I'm watching, especially this season of Discovery, I'll be like, I'm disconnected from the characters, but that's my problem. That's not anything they're doing. But, like, I always feel like, oh, technically everything is good. But, like, this episode, you know, where she's having this emotional journey, you know, with the crying and all that stuff. But I'm like, in this episode, it works. Unfortunately, I've seen it in every single episode this season. So
it's not new.
Well, it's all that to say is, like, it'd be more meaningful if it was this. Now, you know, I tell my wife, Jessica, and she's like, well, you know, this is Star Trek by Shonda Rhimes. So, okay. But I don't know. Do you feel like she's just crying all the time? And I'm not trying to, like...
So this is really interesting because, you know, as somebody who does cry, I find it really funny that people are obsessed with her crying. I was like, she gets teary-eyed. She's not, like, bawling her eyes out every 5 minutes. As somebody who ugly cries on a fairly regular basis.
Seeing your mom that you thought was dead, obvious moment for emotion, like, that's bad.
There are a couple of criticisms that I will defend. Like, I don't personally fight, like, the whispering thing, I don't really see it. And the obsession with the crying, I also don't particularly see. But that's me, and that's kind of where it is. I agree that there is an issue that the arc seems to be very much kind of, well, it depends on what we need to do for this episode, where on the arc she sits. I actually thought during the last episode that maybe there was, like, I actually was sitting there going, oh, I wonder if actually Sneaker Martin Green has decided that she would quite like to kind of move on. And do something different, because it felt very much like that's what they were kind of working to, and I would have got that. Like, would have, I think they could have done it nicely, and it would have made sense.
But nope.
No, absolutely not. And now we're back again. But actually, my concern is that, like, if she was to settle in and just be like a happy science officer who was happy to follow a command for the rest of the season, then I would be okay with that, because we've now done this slightly erratic arc, but we've
done
the
arc. And it's Star Trek, so the science officer is probably going to do quite a bit.
They are.
Star Trek.
Particularly on a science vessel, where they only have one science lab, apparently, despite the fact that they can do 360 distinct experiments. Don't get me started on the science lab.
It's really big because they don't have a main engineering.
Oh, well, that's okay then. That's okay. So is she moving in with Stamets? Because that could be fun. I think it's... We are where we are, and the decisions have been made the way that they are. And I hope that we can just move on from this episode, and hopefully we see less of that, and that is a bit more ensemble. We've kind of done that kind of focus. I suspect we will not necessarily see that, but we shall see. So that was one of the kind of Discovery moments that frustrated me greatly.
To Philip's point, like, this is a unique situation. And whether you like it or not, this character has been constructed in such a way where this is actually a really Michael could be the problem-solving problem just by the virtue of her being Michael because of her relationship with Spock. This could be that solution. And because they've used that so much, because it's like she's always just the solution because she's Michael, I still rolled my eyes at it. Even though I was like, oh, well, she is right. Spock's sister, and like maybe like, there was
they set it up better this way, and it does make sense. Yeah, but
it's because it's been so overblown and so overused like every other episode. I'm just like, oh, now I just feel like she's like using Spock's name in vain, which is a weird thing to say, but it's just like, ugh, okay, whatever.
Well, they I think the term Spock's sister about 72 times in this episode, and I was like,
they did.
She's not actually genetically related to him. She could have spent some Spock's time in the same house.
Stepsister.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the one sister.
Oh, when she rolled up and she's dropping Daughter of Sarek like you know, it's a tome. Like,
no, you're audience.
Listen.
Well, I think one line that...
True fact.
I don't want to go too deep into it of like taking offense because I don't care that much. But there's a line where Michael, and I forget if it was near the end, but we're talking about Spock's legacy, and she's like, "Oh, I guess what I told him really made him the man." I'm like, you know, he has his own agency, like you know,
That ending scene, was rough. I mean, because it was Burnham's mom that suggests that maybe Spock is the way he is because of Michael's influence. Listen. Like you mentioned, Lindsay,
we didn't know Michael existed for how many years.
Well, not just that. I have a biological sister. She's maybe 2% influence on my life as a whole. There's no possible way you can start attributing Spock's awesomeness to Michael Burnham. I'm sorry.
I will absolutely agree with you. However, I do think it is really interesting because we have a tradition and a kind of culture of reinterpreting things based on new facts that we learn at a later date. So it doesn't surprise me that people would go, well, actually, now that I've met this sister, maybe that's why this happened. Like that's kind of what historians do a lot of the time, is kind of go, oh, well, wait, here's
and
this
with
new
television,
piece of
when you're making something later that's actually
the old
earlier.
Retcon.
Like, yeah. All right. Well, but guys, we haven't talked at all about the burn in about 5 minutes, so let's get on.
I think the thing that it's fine. It just makes me laugh. Like how much the present, but I'll say the future people don't give a blank about the burn. Nobody cares about the burn. Yeah, nobody wants
really
to talk about it.
It's
like
150 years in the past. Nobody cares anymore, man. It's like done. It's over.
That's like Picard being like, where did that doomsday machine go? We got to figure that out.
Yeah, like, but legitimately, it has a massive impact on how they live their lives. Now, admittedly, 150 years is possibly long enough for them to have, you know, maybe had a couple of generations and for people to just be used to living the way that they're currently living. But depending on the places and kind of lifespans, there could be a lot of people who remember what it used to be like.
And Lindsay, like, I don't know if it's a, and again, I don't want to talk to forge the writers, but like where you're saying, like, it's right. I mean, Michael's a little bit obsessed, but like, she's not wrong. This is a good mystery, right? But just like, it's like the writers see, like, in order to counterbalance and create conflict, I'm hand quoting, that Michael's interested in the burn, everyone else has to be not interested in the burn. I'm like, you could just be on the same page about it,
that's
right?
True.
You
know, that's true.
Everyone can have their own agenda.
It'd be too much if the head of the Federation was like, I agree with you, Michael. Yeah. Let's commit our resources. No, he has to be staunch opposed to it, which makes her make these choices.
That first scene when they get to Nevar is a perfect example of that because, like, here Saru is trying to open diplomatic relations with these people for the first time ever. And as soon as somebody says no to Michael, she has to, like, the only thing she can think about is the burn. That's
fine. I invoke. Yeah. She blinked a lot.
Just
trying
wait a
to
second. Just
deactivate the president. And that didn't work.
Let's go have dinner on the planet. And then we could talk about it. Just wait a minute, man. This is crazy.
No, I invoke Article 13 of whatever subparagraph 2.
There is something of the kind of impatient toddler, or possibly the impatient elderly person who has forgotten what manners are because they are now old enough to get whatever they want when they want it. I think
she's on the same level. She's representing the Federation, so obviously that's equal to the president of your little planet.
She's not the first officer anymore, but she is representing the Federation. Yeah, the whole thing is just a bit strange.
I also thought the funny part of creating conflict, like, I mean, look, this story is good. I'm making fun of it, but like, it's good. I did enjoy it, but like, they almost have to like go too far. Like, Oh, yeah? The Federation only chose her because you're Spock's sister. No, duh. No, duh. Nobody is arguing that's why we did that. That's it's not a hidden curtain that we...
The only thing they didn't do, which I kind of was almost expecting, was like, is this event to the death? Because it feels like that's the only thing we're missing. It's like, if you don't prove your logic, we kill you.
They just throw the LARP out at her.
It's like that feels like the only thing. Maybe that's a step too far, which is why they didn't do
it. You're missing the other key component missing from sort of classic Trek, which would be doing it in a ridiculously skimpy outfit designed especially for the occasion.
Yeah. Managed to get your shirt off.
Just let me wrestle while wearing a toga.
I just want to see them like seated at a desk and they're like doing like formula and math, and it's like da 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 da.
No, like, wait, you're from the degradation of
the stellar.
It's like, now we go to the blackboard, and da 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 da.
And you know what? We can mock or we can critique the fact that there is actually very little logical argument about the scientific fact in this kind of forum.
But part of that is very much like, this is my opinion, this is your opinion, and we're going to agree to disagree.
But some of the challenges that actually it would have been thoroughly uninteresting to hear a solely logical discussion of the facts of where these items had been. I did, like, there was one bit where I was like, it's just not very logical to have evidence that you're to blame for this, but not to share at least that much proof. Like, absolutely, don't share the science behind SB19.
But like, share the evidence. Our conclusion is that we didn't do it. But we're not going to tell. We can't tell.
But we are also really guilty for having done it, so we're just going to sit here and feel guilty about it. But like, fundamentally, Vulcans are often not very logical, and equally, the Romulans are renowned for their deceit and their general like conniving. So therefore, between them, I'm not really surprised they're not acting in what feels like a particularly open or logical way. But, there we are.
The unification did not actually do the best. It did the worst of the two species.
You would think, though, they would have to. I mean, I get it. It's an episode, and I'm not expecting them to answer every question. But there, you would think that there would be 400 years of decent progress made at this point.
Intermarriage, at the very least.
Because in the way they present the reunification, Spock did all this great work, and now they all live together on the same planet. And then you see the planet, and it's just a microcosm of essentially what we saw in the original unification. It's not like they're living hand in hand. They're all distrustful of each other, and hundreds of years later, this is not something to celebrate.
Okay, so it kind of reminds me.
Oh, no. I was going to say, it reminds me of the Voyager episode where the Doctor is in the future and they have the two species that are like, oh, well, you've always blamed our species for that war, and it actually was that other species. Like, again, two species living on the same planet never seems to work.
Okay, so this is not quite an example of two species living on the same planet, but as a Scot who is also British and has been part of the United Kingdom for circa 400 years, I think what we sometimes forget is that these things are cyclical. Like, there could well have been a period of greater unification followed by a period of a little bit more destabilization. And I think it's really reductionist to think that once a group of people have come together, they can't then choose to break apart again. And maybe that's true of the Federation, like this idea that the Federation got to a point where it was so big it couldn't sustain itself with the resources that it had. And that was some of the kind of the pool that was there.
That's what they kind of talk about, which is interesting.
The challenges of kind of like, how big a group can you maintain, and at what point are certain resources so fundamental that if you don't have enough of them, you have to choose to then behave differently.
And that's true. We say the burn caused the destruction of the Federation, but it almost collapsed under its own size is what it sounds like. I think we did the math a little bit in Picard's time in the Picard series. The Federation had like 100 something worlds, and then in Discovery they've said at its peak it was like 300. So that's like a triple sized Federation. Like, that's a lot of
planets. Was it like a burden sharing problem where it's always Earth?
You got to think that there was a big influx as soon as the Romulan Star was destroyed. Like, they have a very big chunk of, the Romulan Empire, which is like half the Alpha Quadrant or whatever. So
the collapse of the Romulan Star Empire, that, and then we just, sucked all that up. And And we've that's a good point.
And we've also got to think about things like we don't really know how far it traveled, like how far the Federation expanded, I don't think. I know there's been some discussions about actually where was that Starfleet base? Like, where is it? We don't really know, other than the fact that right. it's not very close to anywhere useful. It could be, you know, in the Delta Quadrant for all we know. Probably not. But you never know, because we do get
Wait, that would require Discovery to give us a map, maybe a technical blueprint of some kind.
Oh, bless you guys. You love these things, don't man. You?
Oh, jeez.
Oh, bless.
I've started to draw up my own sketch of, like, way the detached nacelles and how they work, because why not?
You had just gotten your Discovery model technical specifications together, and then they refit the whole thing.
Just like, I mean, I'm trying to figure it all out. But
you know what? A very significant piece of world building that we learn here is that the Vulcans / Romulans developed some sort of non-warp travel technology,
right?
And then just sat on it, just like the Federation did with the spore drive.
Well, here's an interesting thing, because
they said it was dangerous.
So I have a pet theory, which I might have stolen from one of my colleagues on Trek This Out, about the fact that we know that there's some discussion about the Mirror Universe already ongoing. We know that there's been discussion about the Mirror Universe getting further away. We know that something is going on with Georgiou. But we wondered if perhaps whatever it is that SB-19 does, there has been perhaps a little kind of crossover or an infiltration or something that the Vulcans have then gone nix nay with the no, like just no. Because you can't imagine the Vulcans would be very keen.
There's a 50% chance you'll end up in the Mirror Universe, so we're going to say no to this technology and just...
Yeah, so I wonder if we're going to discover that that's what put the kibosh on SB-19.
Well, I've been scouring the internet, and I found a document that says SB-19. This is California Senate Bill number 19.
this isn't Lower Decks.
This is all here. It is about water regulations and the adding of properly monitored valves and gauges. Did you know that less than 14% of the state's significant stream segments are well gauged? Anyway, I won't argue. This thing is extremely boring.
No, but it sounds like it's environmentally sound, and it's about courses of things that couldn't be like. Hello?
I just laughed because SB-19 totally sounds like a Senate bill. But
well, it's interesting because we literally went, what does SB stand for? What is it? What does it mean? What does
Sensor...
it mean?
Senorita Burnham.
Oh no!
Don't make those jokes. Well, we did also have a discussion about the fact that none of us know enough Vulcan to really be able to break that down, unless it's in Federation standard, which the Vulcans do.
But they're not part of the Federation.
But they were when they started this. That? So
what about SB-1 through 18? That's the question. No one's asking.
Well, we also had a discussion about whether it was named before COVID-19.
Oh yeah. Wait. Yeah, of course it's 19, but a little on a different topic, though, there was another little call out, and when they're talking about the black boxes, as we're getting the sciencey science scene with Tilly, is one of them was obtained from the USS Yelchin, which was named after Anton, who we lost several years ago. That was a nice little callback. So we have the Nog and the Eisenberg class and the USS Yelchin, so... A nice little connection there. And guys, color me shocked. Michael's right. There's a difference in like a millionth of a second something. But then Tilly has to go into this whole, well, in three-dimensional space, you need more than 3 points, apparently, so we can't fully triangulate it.
Real quick, though, before we get to, I just want to talk, because you brought that up. No mention of the destruction of Romulus, or that's where Spock died, essentially.
That was hundreds of years ago, Daniel.
No, but then we see
it's true.
Picard's personal logs, which apparently include
which
video
really
files,
cool.
Which is fine, whatever, I get it.
Daniel, he became an android later, so you could have actually...
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Well,
old android with an old android body.
Well, my theory on that is that they use some sort of technology... actually, in this book you guys might have heard of, it's called Ship of the Line.
No.
But actually, no, there's a part where they basically took Kirk's missions and combined them with his logs and special recordings from Kirk to kind of get inside his head on like what he was thinking as the events were going on. And Picard used that kind of as a learning tool. So it made me think they could do the same thing where, you know, as Picard was older and he's talking, you know, in referring to the events of Unification 1 and 2, they could take like a holographic recording of Spock and you have this kind of mesh between memoir and actual news recording, but that lets posterity kind of see in their own words kind of what was happening. So that's my view of what they kind of do.
Though, because William Riker relives the entirety of the NX-01's final mission. So, you know.
Oh, there you go. This is old technology. If he wants to be chef, he can be chef.
Like, let's face it, nobody should ever use that episode as an excuse to ever do anything ever again. however, we have seen it on screen is the ability to recreate something based on mission logs and or whatever else you might have happened to have lying around.
I was just surprised that there was no, because Michael specifically says, I didn't let myself know what happened to him, but then she doesn't even learn what happens to him in the end, which in her universe would be the death of Spock at the destruction of the Romulan star. And there's no mention of that, which I was just surprised. But
well, maybe more later. But I mean, obviously for time purposes, like once I got to the part talking about unification, like that's really all we need. But okay. So let's talk about number one. Because we talked about this last week and we were trying to say, well, who is going to be number one now that Michael is maybe not, maybe she's leaving back then a whole 45 in universe minutes ago. We didn't know, but, we were, I think, leaning towards, not Arium,
right.
Who's also sat in the center seat a couple times, or like a member of the Federation makes a lot of sense.
That lady
like
that was on the bridge,
that's on the bridge a lot. Yeah. We don't really remember her name, but you know,
we had exactly the same thought. Somebody did suggest tonight when we were recording that it should be Stamets, just because that could be quite hysterical and he would be rubbish.
Oh gosh, he'd be so bad.
He would be terrible.
But in and of itself, that could be quite interesting. I think I purposefully said that I did not want them to do this because I think it's a disservice to Tilly's development and her character. Like, I enjoy Tilly as a character. I know everybody does, but I do like her. But yeah, I think this is just a bit insane. However, they've done a thing, and hopefully, you know, we've now got
it. If you could have an acting ensign, you could have an acting first officer.
As
right?
an ensign.
There's the Kirk precedent. You pluck a third-year cadet and make him XO. You know,
precisely. Like, it's
everything's out the window.
And it's okay because he's Kirk, so that's fine. Because obviously his behavior is always sterling.
I mean, we kind of saw this coming because of the lingering shots on Tilly and the way that they're having her like say the right thing around Saru and Saru confiding in her. Like, it's not a huge surprise, but I mean, maybe lieutenant to acting first officer, but like, this is, as she reminds him, she didn't even complete the course. And he's like, Battlefield Commission, you have a lot of experience. You're 900 years older, but you're not. And, you know, and that's tons of experience.
As with many things in Discovery, I am going to try and withhold judgment until I've actually seen what they do with it. Because, like, there is potential. Like, they could actually make her, like, really struggle with it. Like, she could not be good and she could choose to stand down. And that could be an interesting kind of plot development. The danger that she's only doing this as a seat warmer until Michael gets the spot back again.
It makes me think of the TNG episode where Wesley was put in charge of like a task with an actual crew under him, and he like folded like a you know house of cards. Did not do well.
Doesn't it seem like they're setting her up for this? Because it's like she's not ready. Like it's not like a slight against the character. She's young. She's inexperienced. Everybody tells her you're inexperienced. She's just not ready for it, and it's okay to not be ready for it. Like
I know it's the 31st century, but like honestly, like I think more like some sort of position that's like not a yeoman per se, but something that's like has the captain's ear and is like helpful in making decisions. Like that totally sounds like it would fit her.
So she needs to be
an
FDA, really, is what you're saying.
Unpaid intern.
Secret assistant to the regional captain.
But I'm not trying I'm not trying to put her in that role, but I'm like, there's got to be something between...
There's a long history of captains having a member of crew who is not perhaps, you know, their second in command, who is not perhaps a natural kind of immediately part of their hierarchy that they go to and have conversations with. And I think that's really valuable. But yeah, I think this is it's an odd choice. The other thing we've got to think about is that they lost most of their crew before they came into the 32nd century, which I think is where we are now, for a variety of reasons. And they don't appear to have like bulked back up again from like the Federation Depot. So actually, if there's only 86 of them, he's possibly the only one that they don't really need doing what they were already doing.
You know, it's something about Discovery. Yeah. I mean, this is going to be a complaint.
Or is her role with Stamets been replaced with
Adira?
Adira. The yeah,
and so now. Reno.
And Reno too.
Yeah. So now, do we not need her? Because that's kind of happened.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
like she's been supplanted.
They have been cultivating this relationship between Saru and Tilly for a little while now, which is fine. Again,
with the first episode, even when they're yeah. or second episode when they're walking, you know, why did you choose me to walk into the Western Saloon bar? And
but it's just like it's such a blind spot, and this is the thing that the Discovery writers do a lot of the times. It's such a blind spot that there's no extra people. And like that woman who came on the bridge from the future would be like a perfect, this would be like a Voyager situation, right? Where you have one person from this one group.
Yeah.
One person
she doesn't have to have
group.
Character development or be interesting. Just like Voyager.
She doesn't have to have a plot. She could just be avoided. Like they can just avoid her. Like, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe
it's like
Kirk
says, all you
got to
do is sit in the chair. Never let them see you bleed and say black alert when you want to go somewhere. That's it.
Sure
that's all you got to do.
Make sure your shirt's tucked in.
Make sure your shirt's tucked in.
Never leave it
behind.
Go down
with the ship.
That's the
never
one.
Never leave anyone behind.
Okay. Except for when you need to leave them behind for plot reasons.
Yeah.
It's like I was having a conversation the other day about...
It's like what you leave behind, guys.
Oh, bless. The rank and subordination is only acceptable when it's like in the kind of course of saving the captain from their own idiocy. That's allowed. Like, that's the only situation where rank and subordination is allowed.
Well, I'm picturing now, like, the, you know, Starfleet Admiral is going to be like, okay, come over here, Saru. So your first officer was the mutineer Michael Burnham, who promptly went on her own mission.
Twice mutineer now. Yep.
Twice mutineer. And then your backup, your A-game was to bring Ensign Tilly directly, do not pass go, do not collect 200 ranks, and is now
that Admiral, I'm going to tell you right now, doesn't care. He doesn't care about the burn. He doesn't care
about
the crew. He doesn't care about punishment. He doesn't care if you have a spore drive, really. Like,
well, no, but you're right. And I think a lot of that is the fact that Starfleet is not exploring anymore. They've been in survival mode for 100 years, and they're not used to that yet.
Well, one thing, this is going to sound like a complaint, but it's actually, I'm trying to say a good thing here, that Discovery has introduced this bridge crew with their names. We don't need to say it. But
and their personalities and their faces and stuff.
But they're very engaging.
Did I miss the clap moment? Did I miss that?
But they're very engaging. I mean, all of the characters, just despite me not naming their names.
We want to know more about them.
But it seems like, to me, like they're never going to go past tertiary status. Like, they'll have their, like, group moments always, but unless they're going to die, they're not going to have their own episode.
That's true.
So it's like, you would think, like, let's promote one of them, but no. It's only going to be the five characters, you know. That's on the top of my head. I can't remember how many there are.
That's true. And, like, in
Tilly, Saru, Stamets,
Star Trek, you would have, like, a full episode on Ocean, or you'd have one on, you know, communications guy. You know, or something like
well,
that.
That's why we
say
so
that,
excited.
But we've got to be really careful because, like, the number of reasonable episodes about Beverly Crusher or Deanna Troi are actually quite small. Like, they do exist, but they're pretty small, and a lot of their use is absolutely shocking. I will openly admit, like, the last two seasons, possibly three seasons of Voyager, become the Captain, Doctor, and Seven. I do think they could make better use of the crew. I absolutely do. But I think we need to be careful not to put the rest of Trek on a pedestal and to clear it.
No, you're right.
Two or three episodes ago, when we had that episode that was awesomely featuring the security lady, and it was great, and it could have just been an episode featuring the security lady.
And with her history, but now she's leaving.
Her goodbye episode.
The episode where she just leaves.
That's what we're saying. It's always their goodbye episode. Like, we learn more about... we learn more about Arium in the episode where she dies than any other episode before.
Exactly. They never just focus on...
No, I'm trying to think... Who was touched by Commander Nahn? Because there appears to be, like, I mean, you know, like, emotionally, because there's, like, a inheritance. Like, because, you know, a robot lady died, Nahn felt the need to then join Discovery.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And now that Nahn has left, there needs to be someone who was touched by Nahn's, and it's like it's this domino effect of characters who will...
Even the tiny bit of that secondary character interesting stuff that we get has been dropped. Like what happened to Detmer? Who knows?
Yeah.
We still don't know. She knows she needs therapy, but we don't know what's going to happen to her.
Because I called out exactly the same thing. I thought it was an interesting thing that they did. They kind of planted it in one episode. We got some more about it in a secondary episode. And I was like, right, if they walk away and ignore this from now on, I will be irritated. But they haven't done that because there have been several references to various things. There have been moments where she has clearly hesitated. And there have been discussions,
A lot of screen time because we have a lot of other things
precisely.
To cover right
like,
now.
It hasn't been perfect, but they haven't just walked away from it. And heaven knows, as previously stated, I love Voyager, but they were absolutely shocking for the big red reset button of Doom. Oh, look, our captain has a chronic depression, but we're just going to ignore it now because we've had that episode. I think Trek has its problems all the way through and Discovery has its own special problems, but... I'm going to push through.
I will say here, and here, I'll switch tracks here and be a little positive. I could kind of tell what they were doing when they cut short the conversation between Tilly and Stamets. You could kind of tell where they were going. I loved, of course, we get a very Lower Decks.
Well, he was
scene.
Super like honest, and you felt like. Well, yeah. If she had stayed around like 3 more seconds, he would have said, but.
He was exactly.
And then here's your redeeming qualities.
Strange, it's weird, but. And then we get that Lower Deck scene of everybody being super supportive of her changing, you know, like, yay, everybody claps for her and everything.
So, tell me what to do, boss.
So that's
send me into danger.
Oh, by the way, here's a list of all the things I want to complain about.
That was sweet.
I do like that this ship is not built necessarily on experience and competency, but the power of friendship. And, you know, I'm not going to argue with that. It's my little discovery.
The power of friendship will get you anywhere
and
in the galaxy.
And then Michael's late. She's like, did I miss the clapping part? Aww. Or what did she say? It wasn't the clapping. It was like the affirmative
yes
or something.
Say yes to the dress.
Did they have like a scene like that in real life? Like, was the actress wanting to like renew her contract and she wasn't sure? And they're all like,
not going to renew unless A, my husband gets a part, and B, I'm made XO. Those are my terms.
You had a lot of power.
And Discovery's like, oh, we thought you would have wanted your own ship, but sure, we'll make that happen.
You can still bunk in with Tilly. It's fine. Like,
and no more scenes with cats. I swear to God.
Oh, we got a very, very clear nod to the fact that the cat is not a cat in this episode. There was a very
I must have missed it. What happened?
Oh, there was a really poignant look where Book looks very specifically at the cat, and there's a reference to the sitting here at home looking after your cat. He's like, I think we all know that there is something going on there. It's just a question of what this cat turns out to be.
It doesn't have a horn taped to its forehead, so we can't tell if it's an alien. So,
well, I like. There's a bit of me that thinks it's a shapeshifter. I kind of want it to be a changeling.
Ooh, is there going to be a murder and it turns out the cat did it? I mean, we've done the dog did it. So,
wait, what are they going to do with Book now? Because it feels like he's got nowhere to go and he's just dead weight at this point.
He's just living in his van down by the river.
He's just living in the van in the cargo bay. He watches movies with everybody Friday nights and stuff.
He has to clear the...
No, he has to park it outside, just outside the ship.
If I see him with a tube taking it out...
I mean, you can tell that they specifically designed his ship. They're like, okay, here's version one of the ship. Okay, that's great, Bob. But it's got to fit like permanently... in this cargo bay, so you gotta take it down by 20%.
We saw that, so
it's quite funky.
It's true.
No,
that's how it did a U-turn.
Somebody did point out to me that actually, if Book's character was female, I'd probably be on a high horse complaining about the way that they're treating him, because he does appear to literally be living in the cargo bay waiting for her to come by for like a Nookie visit. which given...
Yeah, she's Burnham's apartment, so she doesn't have to live under her dad. You know,
this is very like Worf living in the Defiant. Like, it's a little bit weird, but we're not going to talk about it.
It's so true.
And you know what? I think it's interesting because we know enough about his character to know that he does have skills and talents. He just doesn't appear to be using them just now, which is slightly odd. His forehead was glowy.
Oh, I was going to say, are we ever going to see him rescue an animal again? Was it just like maybe. Established character done?
I'm telling you, the cat is special.
Okay.
Saru's gonna give his first orders to First Officer Tilly to deal with the drifter that's sitting in the cargo bay.
The squatter.
Please get rid of your bunkmate's significant other from our cargo bay, please.
It's starting to stink in there. He's like, I don't know what's going on.
Well, he's also been inside the super secret Federation headquarters now. I'm gonna throw that out there. Also, they had all these refurbs and they redid the spore drive, but they appeared not to have actually done any testing because it seemed like that was the first time they had done a thing since.
It's all cosmetic changes, you know. The inside wiring's still the same, so I'm sure.
Oh yeah, it works. Like, but the augments are gone, but you know, that's fine. And this is about last week, but I get very sad when Dr. Culber gets cheated out of the ability to take off the augments from his own husband. I feel like he'd probably manage that. Jira could have backed off. Stop showing off, girl.
But, yeah. any other thoughts on Unification 3? I think, you know, there's a lot definitely going on. And, you know, we don't have too much left in this season. I think, what is it, like 13 episodes I think we're getting up to? Can't quite recall. We're in episode 7 right now. So
halfway there.
A little under halfway. Halfway there. Living on a prayer. I feel like there's this underlying resentment from Burnham whenever we arrive at a planet that left the Federation. Like, how dare you? Like, how dare you, Trill? Like, how dare you, Vulcan?
I feel the reverse of it, and I get it. Conflict, blah, blah, blah. Like, does every planet have to be dicks? Like, I mean, like, every planet. Like, they've never... Discovery, yeah. I just want them to go to one planet this season, show up, and they're like,
not at all pleasurable.
Hey, Discovery, welcome. Welcome. But it's always like, what do you want? No. And you're stupid. And I'm like, is this the future?
Even this time, they're like, we know we were told about your spore drive, but how did you sneak past our outer perimeter defense?
And the answer is no to your first question.
You invited us here. Yeah.
So wait. But here's the thing. Here's my question then. If we're going to project into the future and see where we're going. We went to Trill. Unexpected. I'm sure none of us saw that coming because of the character who is a Trill. We, of course, went to Vulcan because of Michael Burnham.
Michael Burnham's... Did you know she's Spock's sister?
I did know that.
But there's a very big part of the, Star Trek universe that we don't know about or understand. Oh. We haven't seen Klingons or Borg or...
Oh, I thought you were saying we're going to go back Andoria? To Kaminar. Kelpia. Kaminar.
Yeah, we could. But do we? Where do we think... And we don't know, but what do we want to see?
If only we had signals to tell us where to go.
Beta Z.
Should we go to Beta Z? Yeah.
I want to go to Talax. I want to, like, you know.
Oh, boy.
I think it'd be Talax.
Or not Talax. I want to go to Talax.
Wait a minute. I know you like Voyager. Wait a minute.
Yeah. Didn't they have, like, that environmental disaster from the Cascade?
Mr. Kelpian, welcome.
I think for me, like, the bit that we haven't seen with the spore drive yet is that there doesn't seem to be any real limits to their travel capacity. So it would be lovely to take us back to something from the Delta Quadrant. I think that would be really interesting.
Or the Gamma Quadrant.
The Gamma Quadrant is only full of, like, evil.
Can we go through the wormhole again? Our wormhole's passé now. Cool.
That could be the cat's homeworld. You don't know. There you go. Perfect.
That's right.
Oh, that would be interesting to go to the Dominion.
Future Jem'Hadar. Yeah.
Like,
Jem'Hadar?
Maybe they're like the peacekeepers these days. Who knows?
True. They have like blue.
Can we see some absolute Canada?
They have blue helmets
the
now that they wear.
They'll be like one of the core members of the Federation. We just haven't learned that yet because nobody appears to have looked at the database to check these things.
Wait, so we folded the Dominion into the Federation, but we've just lost contact. So they're just living their best lives over on that side of the galaxy. They have no idea what's going on.
I like that point, Lindsay, that like, and I get it because it's an episode, you know, but like at no point is like Captain Saru like, I'm going to be in front of a computer for like 3 hours just catching up on 900 years, guys. You know, it's like the Kelpians were part of the Federation. Yeah, just research, man. I don't know what to tell
you. Our Vulcans changed the same. Like, I totally get not looking up what your brother got up to, but I kind of feel like check it out, like, you know,
like when you press the button to your updated library to the navigation and you're like VU, you're not recognizing anything. VUL, am I spelling it right, guys?
It's clearly not a Windows product, because if it was a Windows product, you type in Vulcan and it would take you directly to Navarre.
There's just like
at
a little.
Go to the Wikipedia page, man. Just to
the predictive
see.
Text like, is all shot.
You put Vulcan, there's like a little red line underneath it when you hit the button.
Next name.
Well,
Vulcan.
Next...
Did you mean Navarre?
Did you mean
No, I didn't.
I meant Vulcan.
No, but like, I think like this is the perfect opportunity to revisit some of these kind of peripheral. Is that we're going to struggle to do unless we're either in the future or
Denobula.
Well, Denobula or the Devor or the crazy time people, Cremax?
Krennic.
Like, these are great species that we could totally bring back into a thing.
Lindsay, I'm all for, now that we've established the precedent,
just pull off those forehead
of
molds.
Just doing
and be good.
Crazy sequels out of sequence. So, Year of Hell Part 3 coming.
Yes!
25 years later, or whatever it is.
That would be. Can we just say that?
Can that be the name of the title?
With Janeway in it.
No, I was going to say that would be covering Michael's Lost Year. Is the
no? See, so here's the thing. This would be awesome. You guys have an awesome idea for season 4 of Discovery.
Well, I'm glad the writers listen to this podcast.
As you solve this stupid burn problem, right, and it just becomes
it was old man McGregor.
And then the show just becomes let's rebuild the Federation, and then you can go anywhere. Then you could just say let's make a season like season 4 of Enterprise, where you just start pulling in stuff from all the other shows, and you just say like, yeah, let's go to this crazy planet that they visited once, see what it's like 1,000 years in the future, and try to get them involved. That would be awesome. That would be a super cool thing to do.
So I think we have to be careful though, because like as somebody who doesn't particularly like TOS, season 4 of Enterprise is not my favorite.
I understand.
And that's the challenge there. Like, you have to find that balance between contemporary arc building and referential
and
kind of stuff.
Massive fan service.
Yeah, I think you probably can find it, but I think it's a hard job.
Well, and like you said, Lindsay, like, there's no downside to the Spore Drive right now. So
that's
kind of hard to, but it's kind of hard to write around. I mean, except for the fact that only you need Stamets to make it run. So, like, that's literally the only limitation. But it's like, how do you write a plot where, let's say, where it's 3 years from now and every ship in the Federation can instantaneously go anywhere? It's like, that changes things.
It does.
But
and it doesn't.
Not necessarily in a good way.
No, it just changes things. And I think if you are part of a fleet of 5 ships, for example, because, like, you know, Voyager J could definitely be fitted out. I don't know quite how it would get the spinny thing going, but I'm sure we could work something out. Like a little, like...
the diamonds all like looked like a glitched pixel in a video game.
It would be great. But like, you know, if you've got a fleet of 5 ships that have got spore drive capacity, like dotting around, then that could definitely work as a kind of like...
I'm sorry, the Voyager J has to have its detached nacelles move into a new position when it's ready to go to warp.
I don't know why anybody would criticize that. Voyager is a beautiful ship. It has a beautiful theme tune. That's all the world needs to know. Yeah, so I think like there's definitely some capacity there. I am a big fan of what could be termed sort of medical angst. I like it when people are like traumatized and injured and generally put through the mill. So I had a real issue with the fact that we went from the end of episode 2, whereby people were like dying in Jeffrey's tubes, to like apparently 30 minutes later, whereby everybody was fixed and well. Like, I think you're right in that having only Stamets being able to use it is a really interesting plot device just now, and it is the only thing that kind of manages the use of the spore drive.
Are they going to run out of mushrooms eventually?
I still don't think it does, though, because they've already introduced the idea that something else can do it.
Well, they can do, but they've got some control over when they introduce that, because for the time being. And again, this is it. Like, there was a thing last week about the fact that, oh, Burnham can't go do this because we're on standby. I'm sorry, if you're the only ship that can go anywhere at any speed, presumably you are always on standby, which also presumably means that Stamets is also on standby and can't ever have a drink. But, like, that's harsh.
But literally, if this should be the number one priority of the entire Federation right now, if they can all figure out what makes the spore drive work, then it does not matter what happened in the burn.
Daniel,
because we're not explorers anymore, Daniel.
Now
it doesn't matter.
A better propulsion system you ever had before.
Okay.
And everybody can do it at that point.
Well, there is also the concern that you don't want to degrade the mycelial network. We know that what was going on in the Murray universe is they were pulling too much power, and that was corrupting everything. We don't know what too much is. Again, that's a plot device that they could use to try and limit it, but they haven't.
Too much.
Well, they haven't been clear about that. They haven't kind of explicitly said we can't have multiple spore drives.
Technical documents to show us exactly how the spore drive worked, then we would all
Daniel
totally
challenge them to a logic off.
I swear my logic is more extreme than yours.
Daniel, I want to tell you, Starfleet don't care. They don't care about your spore drive. They don't care about the burn. They don't care about finding the Federation.
They're
just happy doing what they're doing. That can't be bothered.
I like the Admiral.
He's cool because he doesn't care about anything.
He's
really.
That's fine.
Yeah.
He's cool because he was in The Mummy. That's why he's cool.
Well, I can't deny that.
We could have Cronenberg do something. I mean, we still haven't tugged on that.
Oh, well, he's clearly Section 31. And from
could they have not upgraded to 32 by now? It's been like hundreds of years.
31 day.
Even worse.
Which is the oddest bra measurement in the history of mankind. But there's... Like, I think, yeah, so he was talking about with Georgiou about, like, you know, they've identified the genetic components that make the mirror people mirror and you therefore evil. Like, I have to think that he's done something sneaky there and is trying to, like, mirror our version of Georgiou, which I think is interesting because that would...
Like, he might have infected her?
Well, I don't know. Infected is not the word I would have used. But, I do think that whether... Whatever he's done is resulting in her remembering things differently and therefore building some kind of guilt complex.
Maybe he's like resetting her to normal universe somehow, like her memories are getting...
Yeah, and I wonder if that's...
Kind of like a quantum level.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's something that's going to make whatever the Section 31 series is or is not a little bit different, because I know there's a lot of chat about you can only get so far with...
Is there a Section 31 series?
I don't know.
We'll never really.
It's shadowy and secret.
Precisely. You'll only ever get it with the special password on the special day at special time.
And I'm fine with that. I'm fine with that.
When the moon of Vulcan of Navarre is is full moon. Wait, but Navarre has no moon.
But it has two suns.
That's true. So does another planet. But next week we have the Sanctuary. I think I can't even remember the outro from this episode.
You don't get the outro. We don't get those.
I'm trying to remember. I think it's, I don't know, another mission to find stuff.
The Sanctuary sounds like it should be to do with Book's little kind of hidey hole for his animals.
That's true.
They're called some sort of worms, tube worms?
Trans worms.
Yeah. Trans worms, that's what it is, yeah. That's
right. Do they bring space worms? Is that, or am I thinking of
that? It must flow. All right. Well, Lindsay, thank you for joining us and talking about this episode and talking about Star Trek and all the things we enjoy about it. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you for having
me. Where would someone find you if they wanted to talk even more about Unification Part 4?
Yes.
Whenever that comes.
Absolutely. Or the Year of Hell Part 3. I could be found at Twitter at LHA. So it's LHA underscore again. Or you can find me on my home podcast, which is at Trek This Out Pod.
Wonderful. And Daniel, if someone wanted to talk to you about your extreme logic, where would they find you?
They could find me on Twitter as well. My handle there is One of Dan. That's the number one, not the word, as in Romulans are the best, but they keep getting the short end of the stick, man. I got to be okay. Anyways, yeah, you can find me there.
And Philip, someone wanted to talk to you about the resurgence of the newest shoulder pad fashions coming back on Navarre. Where would they find you?
Yeah, you know, you can only wear one because you're unified now. They can find me.
Just one shoulder pad.
Yeah. They can find me on Twitter.
Imagine Tom Alok with one shoulder pad.
Yeah, and you only have the one forehead thing. So it's like, you know, anyway.
Oh, man. Yeah. One ear? Sheesh.
But they can find me at NC Public Servant.
And if someone wanted to talk to me about the secret spore drive building facility orbiting Jupiter, they can find me on Twitter, Instagram. That's where we put all our secret facilities under username Dr. Sci-Fi, DrSciFi. Well, I'm Darren Moser.
I'm Philip Gelfis.
I'm Daniel Prue.
Oh, and I'm Lindsay.
Stranded here on City Alpha 4.